Hello, and welcome to my latest podcast episode, which is Janine Green ASB Chats CCE. Now, you'll see that things are slightly different today. Usually, I use my nice podcast software to record these episodes, but unfortunately, it turns out that technology is not my friend today. So, we are using Zoom, and we were going to put videos up. So, you're actually going to see me interviewing my guest. And then we realised that technology was failing us again because it refused to do it with the videos on, and we were subject to lots of pausing and freezing. So this is pretty much plan C, which is record it on Zoom, but without videos. So it'll still be an audio episode and hopefully won't affect the quality of what you're listening to or the enjoyment or the benefit of what you're going to hear and learn about today. So I'm really delighted to be able to welcome Nikki from Safer Together, who I encountered on LinkedIn because I saw some posts that really kind of caught my eye. And I think as ASB officers and housing officers, we talk a lot about having to wear lots of different hats and having to have knowledge of lots of different subject areas. And I think CCE, so child criminal exploitation, is one of those areas that it's really important for housing and ASB officers, one, to have knowledge of, but also to be included in the agenda of. And I'm really pleased to have Nikki, who's going to talk us through what we mean by the expression CCE, how that might pan out in some of the things that we get involved in, and also hopefully some practical tips and guidance around how we might engage with health services. So Nikki, a huge welcome. And I'm going to start by asking if you might introduce yourself in a little bit more detail than I have. Perhaps tell us a little bit about your experiences and your current role.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on. So my name is Nikki Holmes, and I am the owner and the founder of Safer Together. And I decided to launch Safer Together in the middle of a global pandemic, which I'm not sure whether that was a great idea or not. We'll find out as time goes on. But yeah, my organisation basically provides training consultancy, project management for a variety of different organisations, both statutory and non-statutory, around any topic to do with children, young people, vulnerable families, safeguarding, and also SEN, so special educational needs and disabilities. And the reason that I decided to launch Safer Together was because safeguarding and promoting the rights and welfare of children and young people has always been my greatest passion, really. And I've always worked in safeguarding and with children and young people.
Lovely, thank you for that. So my first question is kind of taking us back to basics a little bit, really. So if there's anyone listening that doesn't, maybe hasn't heard of the expression CCE before, or perhaps they have, but they're thinking, I'm not quite sure what it means. Could you just give us an overview of what's meant by child criminal exploitation? Have I lost you?
Yeah, of course. So child criminal exploitation is basically the process. Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry. We're really struggling, aren't we, today?
We are. We'll do it. We'll get through this.
So child criminal exploitation is basically the process of grooming, manipulating and coercing children and young people to commit acts of a criminal nature for the purposes of financial gain. And that's really key. There's always some financial gain, not just to the children and the young people involved in child criminal exploitation who are being exploited, but the biggest gains are for the organised criminal networks and the gangs that are exploiting them. And children who are criminally exploited, they may have a really varied demographic. So it's really important to keep that in mind, that this is an issue that can impact on any child, any young person from any background. You know, I think if we look at some of the media reports and the reporting in the papers around criminal exploitation of children, it tends to paint it as a black issue, you know, looking at the knife crime and the gang problem in London. It's absolutely not. It's occurring to children from all cultures, all backgrounds, not just those backgrounds where there's an element of economic deprivation, but also what we're seeing more commonly, and this may be one of the results of the pandemic, is that there's an increasing cohort of children and young people who are being criminally exploited, who are from affluent backgrounds, who have never been known to any services, that have not been on anybody's radar. And the reason for that is because the main aim of any organised criminal network is to avoid detection. And using children who have got no criminal history, no criminal footprint, who are not in the gaze of professionals in any capacity, you know, those, what they're called as clean skins, mean that they're more likely to avoid any means of detection. And it's interesting because that there's more reports coming out now around the involvement of girls and young women who are being criminally exploited. I think the focus has always been on women and young women and girls being sexually exploited, and not much consideration given to them around criminal exploitation for whatever reason. But because of this change in recruitment, because that's what they do, they recruit young people into this way of life and coerce them, you know, again, girls, they're more likely to go under the radar. They're less likely to be considered as being involved. And the other thing, what I would say when we're thinking about child criminal exploitation, is we always need to be mindful of vulnerability. So there will always be some form of vulnerability. So, you know, we talk about how there's a varied demographic, but there is one commonality, and that commonality is a vulnerable factor. And that can be substance misuse, it could be some kind of debt, not just debt associated with substance misuse, it might be family debt, it might be debt through gaming, you know, children, young people during the lockdown, spending a lot more time online, might incur debt through that way. That vulnerability as well might be SEND, so some special educational need or disability. But one vulnerability that I'm really keen to highlight that I think is commonly overlooked is bullying. And the reason that I mention bullying is because I think that some young people, they purposely do align themselves with gangs because for them it makes sense to align themselves with the very people that make them feel unsafe, as a protective factor. So, you know, if you've got a young person who might have experienced some peer-on-peer violence or witnessed it, it absolutely makes sense for them to align themselves with peers that are the perpetrators of that violence as a protective mechanism.
Yeah, that's incredibly interesting. And just picking up on a couple of things that you've mentioned there, you talked about, you know, these kind of gangs recruiting and coercing. Can you kind of give me some examples of how they do that, kind of what tactics they use to coerce?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, online is a space where a lot of recruitment and coercion takes place, through violence as well. So, you know, substance misuse is a real factor. So there are some young people who might be recreationally using substances, and then that spirals for whatever reason into a more habitual use. And with that might come drug debt. So it might be that they first are given substances for free, without really being quite naive to the fact that at some point they are going to be expected to pay that debt back, and that it's not free, that they will incur a debt. Other tactics as well. Really, if you think about some of the young people and the deprivation that they live in, and, you know, they do aspire to have nice clothes, a nice car, they might be out of school, and for them those things are, they seem really unobtainable because they're not in school, they're not going to have qualifications necessarily. And so for them, if they are offered an opportunity to make money and make money quickly, and money that they would not make if they were in any form of legitimate training or employment, that as well can be used as a form of coercion. And you know, I think that there's a lot of young people as well that we kind of think, okay, so they might have got involved in this lifestyle because of the economic gain. But it's more than, for a lot of these young people, it's a lot more than just having the latest tracksuit or the latest trainers. If you think about the deprivation that they've grown up in, there are some young people who will be involved in this criminal activity and will be contributing to family finances. And that makes the detection of criminal exploitation really challenging, because we can't always be reliant on their parents and carers to raise the alarm or to raise a flag. If they are also seeing some benefit of this.
You talked about there being a kind of increase in the amount of girls that are being exploited. Are there different methods kind of employed in terms of getting girls involved? Or is it similar in terms of how they go about trying to recruit females? Is it the same as with males?
I think there are some different methods. I think, you know, when I talked about being aware of criminal exploitation, I think that there's a lot of people that wouldn't consider girls and females as wanting to be affiliated with this kind of lifestyle, because they would be almost repulsed by the violence, you know, and that kind of thing that they would be exposed to. But actually, if you think about popular culture, there's sometimes it feels glamorous, that kind of lifestyle. Again, economic gain. But I think as well with girls, sometimes it starts as a relationship, what they deem in their head as a relationship. So this is where criminal exploitation and that sexual exploitation often converge. So they might be recruited but not know they're being recruited into a relationship which they feel is a legitimate, safe relationship, but actually there's that power imbalance there, and it's not until they maybe try to leave that relationship that they realize that they have been exploited. And again, I think that that is a real challenge in educating girls and young women about exploitation, because part of the challenge is it's not until they are really entrenched in exploitation that they identify themselves as a victim. You know, it's quite similar in a lot of ways to what we see with domestic violence and abuse, that coercion, that manipulation, that control.
I suppose it's one of those things that we never think it's going to happen to us, do we? So trying, you know, I can understand that, you know, trying to educate a young girl before it happens. Very difficult. And what, can I just ask a bit more around the type of activities that these young people are being recruited for?
Yeah, so predominantly, when we talk about county lines, what's that is referring to is the trafficking of drugs. So how the county lines model really came about was that drug markets in the big cities, so, you know, Birmingham, London, Manchester, Liverpool, they were becoming really saturated. And because of that, profit margins were decreasing. And what organised criminal networks established was that those drug markets in coastal towns and geographically isolated rural areas were less established, and therefore there was a real business opportunity there to deal drugs in those areas. Less competition meant increases in profit. But with that activity always comes the risk of detection. And if the police do detect that activity, then those organised criminal networks, they can be disbanded. So again, it comes back to that, how do they avoid detection? And that's where children come in. So they will be used, children will be used to basically move drugs from what is essentially an urban nucleus into those areas, those more rural coastal areas, to sell drugs and establish a drug market, and then to come back with money. some of which they get to keep, the majority of which goes into the organised criminal network.
Mm.
So, you know, children used because less likely to be picked up by the police, although as awareness is increasing around how the business models operate, I think that we need to be aware of how children might be used differently. And I know I've touched on that really about how they might now be using girls, they might be using children with no criminal footprint. So that's something else that we need to consider, that as business models change at lightning speed, we need to try and keep up with that. And I'm not sure that there's any system at the moment that has that flex to do so. And that's a real challenge.
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting point about that, you know, that there isn't a stereotypical type of young person that's vulnerable to exploitation.
Yeah.
And on that note, I suppose my next question is around, so as frontline officers, what signs can we look for? I mean, you've mentioned obviously substance misuse and deaths. Are there any other signs that we might see as frontline officers that might suggest that there's some problem?
Yeah, and I was thinking about this actually when I knew I was going to do this podcast, because I think that the signs of exploitation can be a real challenge to spot. You know, I work in health, and I think for health practitioners, your GPs, you know, those clinicians in A&Es, it can be really difficult to unpick, is this exploitation or is this something else? You know, like normal teenage behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for frontline ASB officers, the signs of exploitation might be a bit more over and explicit. So, for example, what you might see is if you are in an area where it is economically deprived and then you see some really flashy cars, and who's getting out of those cars? Young people, if they're coming out of cars and it's in the middle of the school day. So really being mindful of the time of day, seeing young people who you think they actually should be in school. It's not the holidays, so why are they here? Because, you know, like I go back to the point of cars, because taxis and Ubers were commonly used to traffic children. And when we're talking about children going from one area to another, we're talking about the trafficking of children. But actually going back to how business models change, that as organised criminal networks know that there's been training for Uber drivers to spot the signs of exploitation, they might use other methods to traffic children. So rental cars are being more commonly used. And the type of rental car is quite important, because they tend to be flashy, because that's part of the pull, that's part of coercion. They drive around and you know, you've got young people looking at those cars thinking, I want a car like that. I want to get in that car. And they're curious about the car, and it's a real pull factor. So yeah, one other factor as well, I think, is if you see young people in the area and you're hearing them and they're talking in an accent that isn't a local accent, that can also be a factor that I think is overlooked sometimes. You know, where have they come from? Trying to identify where they might have come from. So if you're in Birmingham and you've got young people talking in a Scouse accent, why are they in Birmingham? You know, they're miles away from home. Also, I think if you've got residents that are raising concerns around antisocial behaviour, youth violence, lots of young people hanging around. And as well, I think thinking about cuckooing, if you're thinking about children and people being in the proximity of an address where you've got a vulnerable occupant or might be a known substance misuser, or if there's people coming and going to a certain address at strange times and multiple times throughout the day, they can all be signs of exploitation happening within that locality.
That's really, really helpful. I suppose for the listener, they might be thinking, I think, you know, what you say about accents and stuff is really interesting and something I hadn't thought about. But I suppose some people listening would kind of go, well, what do I do with that? Because just because I've noticed that somebody, that a young person in the area has got a Liverpoolian accent and we're in Birmingham, who would be interested in that kind of information? So I suppose just from a very practical point of view, if a worker did come across any of those kind of signs that you've alluded to, where would they take that knowledge to? Who would they share that with?
So I think that the most common sense place to share any intelligence is with the police. So there's multiple ways you can do that, because, you know, a lot of people say, well, I've just kind of got a good feeling, or it wouldn't be threshold for any sort of statutory intervention. I don't know the names of these young people. It's just a gut feeling. It's just something that isn't right. It's just my observations. But I would say, don't ever get tied up with thinking about threshold. Would this meet threshold for this service or that service or for any intervention? Even if it is a gut feeling and that nagging doubt, report it. And there's two ways you could do that. I would say either through Crime Stoppers. I think that's underused, and that's a good resource for any local intelligence to be fed into. But also get to know who are your neighbourhood police officers or PCSOs, and have that regular contact with them. Because essentially you're the eyes and ears on the ground, and you will see things that a PCSO doing a foot patrol might not, because as soon as they see that uniform, they might behave very, very differently. So yeah, definitely Crime Stoppers. Get to know your neighbourhood policing teams. If there's a significant concern that a child is being harmed or injured, then obviously that would be call 999. Or if you know details of a young person and you're concerned about any safeguarding issue, then I would always advise that you refer that through your multi-agency safeguarding hub as well. So have the details of your MASH to hand, so you know where to put that information into.
That's great. And I think I really like you picked up Crime Stoppers there, because I would agree with you that I think Crime Stoppers is heavily underused and undervalued, perhaps, because of course the benefit of that is that it's anonymous reporting. And I know the last time I looked at Crime Stoppers, you don't even have to pick the telephone up anymore. You can do it through a kind of online contact form,
yeah.
Which I think if you're a resident particularly, and maybe you're seeing things that are worrying you, you know, not actually even having to speak to a human is makes you feel even more secure about making that report. So I totally endorse Crime Stoppers. I think it's particularly where you've got areas where you might have kind of high levels of criminality, high levels of intimidation, you tend to get low reporting, which of course then makes it very difficult for anyone to take any action to make it better. And I think Crime Stoppers is a great way of trying to overcome that obstacle. So yes, absolutely concur with you on that one. Interesting, I think you're absolutely right. And again, from a very practical point of view, I think if there's anyone listening that doesn't know the details of their local MASH, their multi-agency safeguarding hub, and how to refer in, then that, if there's one takeaway perhaps from today, it's please go away and find out how you do that, because I think that's really crucial. One of the things that I hear quite often from frontline officers, however, is a kind of frustration, because they, you know, they make these referrals and they're told that they don't meet the thresholds for intervention, yet for them the case seems really serious. What can an officer do if they, you know, if they do get that kind of response that the threshold's not been met? Is there anything they can do to challenge that or kind of overcome that?
Yeah, definitely. What I would say, it's not uncommon as well in other organisations to hear something quite similar, that you make a referral, you don't know what happens to that referral, or that it doesn't meet threshold. If you are significantly concerned, I would say the first thing to do is to think about what you need to put on the paper of that referral or on that online form, however that referral goes in. And before you press submit or, you know, before you send that form off, I would say look at it again or ask a colleague to look at it who might not have awareness of the situation that you're reporting. And ask yourself, does that accurately convey the risk in the way that it needs to? Because sometimes with a referral, when, you know, I've sat with practitioners that have been really concerned that their referral has not been taken forward, they say, I can't understand it. You know, I've seen this, I'm worried about that. Mm-hmm. But then you look at what's on paper and it doesn't actually convey all of the knowledge that they've got in their head about that incident. So just pause and really think about, is everything on that paper, everything that I'm worried about, And I always say as well, a top tip about making a referral is ask, be really explicit about the response that you want and be prepared to proactively chase that referral. So if you don't hear within 48 hours or 24 hours, depending on the arrangement with the MASH, pick up the phone and follow that up. And if it doesn't meet threshold, you can absolutely ask why. And it might be that they need to get other information from other sources. And I would say don't be disheartened as well, because some people say, well, I don't refer in to the MASH because I never get anything back from it, or they never take my referrals on board. It's always about pieces of the puzzle. Mm. So it could be the next day you see something again involving exactly the same young person. And I would always say put in another referral, keep filtering that intelligence through, because that could be the absolute final piece of the puzzle.
It's also, it's a terrible thing to say, but it's also really important as officers and organisations that we protect ourselves as well. So, you know, that we show that if we've recognised as a safeguarding concern that we've made those referrals, regardless of whether we you know, have any hope of getting a response or not, it's really important that we show that we've taken the right steps.
Definitely.
I'm really interested in looking at this kind of perpetrator victim kind of concept, because one of the things that I saw, probably about 8 or 9 months ago now, was a report from the MPCC around, or it might have been HMRC, but it was around how police were looking at and defining issues of CCE, and this idea that actually what we were doing was treating victims as perpetrators. And I'm just interested to hear your kind of expert opinion on that, in terms of, you know, are some of these young people being treated as perpetrators when really they should be thought of more as a victim, and what problems that causes?
100%. You know, when we think about the Modern Slavery Act that came into play in 2015, and yet we are still, exactly as you say, seeing young people being criminalised and prosecuted and put into prison and young offender institutions for committing criminal offences whilst they've been a victim of exploitation. And it was a couple of days ago, actually, I saw a post that they're a really great organisation, and I would recommend that anyone who's got an interest in this area that they follow them, either on LinkedIn or Twitter, is by Space, and they're the Stop Prevent Adolescent Criminal Exploitation. That they're just great. They put some great content out there which really highlights all things exploitation. And they highlighted a case of, he was 19 when he was incarcerated, 17 at the time, I think, 17 when he was involved in the offence. He was sent to Carlisle, miles away from his local authority area where he lived, as part of County Line's activity, and he received custodial sentence for 16 months for 2 counts of possession with intent to supply Class A drugs, heroin and crack cocaine. And what was really interesting about that case is that the police found on his person, when they did a search, instructions given to him by people higher up the supply chain. So, you know, people who was on a different hierarchy, much higher up within that organised criminal network, telling them where he needed to go and what he needed to do. So for me, there is no clearer evidence that that young person was being criminally exploited. But despite that, the judge in the case gave, obviously passed that sentence. And the purpose of passing that sentence was to basically give a message for anyone who, I think his words were to go on a jolly to supply drugs, the message that they wouldn't be treated leniently by the courts. And that is so frustrating, because obviously as part of the Modern Slavery Act, one of the provisions of it is the statutory defence under section 45. And that defence should basically be available for any young person who is a victim of exploitation and who commits certain criminal offences, and not all criminal offences, you know, offences such as rape and murder are excluded. but possession of drugs and supply of drugs isn't, and therefore they should be able to exercise that defence if they're being coerced, and there's evidence of coercion and exploitation. In this case, there was. And why it's frustrating as well is I think that the police are doing a really great job now in recognising exploitation and responding to vulnerability. And the police take a completely different stance to the courts in a lot of cases. So for the police, the way that they tackle this problem is their main aim is to rip out the hearts of organised criminal networks. And they're not going to do that by simply arresting children and vulnerable children at that and putting them in prison. That isn't their concern. Their concern is to get to the absolute heart of the OCGs. It's just so frustrating. And I think that there's a real lack of understanding of the victim-offender overlap and of the processes, the psychological processes that underpin coercion, manipulation and control. And if anyone's particularly interested in that, understanding manipulation and coercion, I would recommend having a look at Biddeman's framework, which gives a real good insight into those psychological processes of manipulation.
Lovely. There's a couple of things that you've mentioned there, particularly like the sound of space and the framework that you've just mentioned. With your permission, I'll share details of that with this post on my website so people can access those resources, if that's okay.
Yeah, definitely.
I just to kind of, I suppose, expand this principle a little bit more. I mean, as frontline officers, we might also have our own perceptions, assumptions, you know, unconscious biases, which is a bit of a buzzword at the moment, I think. How can we work to overcome and challenge our own perceptions?
I'm really glad you raised that, because I think that's really, really important. And I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet at the moment, which you might be aware of, because I've been talking about it on LinkedIn, about the media's role in influencing perception, assumption and unconscious bias. I think that the way the media report child criminal exploitation is just completely inaccurate and unhelpful and actually harmful. And really, there's a lot of people who, if they're not an expert in this field or they don't work in this field, of exploitation, their knowledge of it comes from the media predominantly. And so I think it's about just pausing and really asking yourself honestly what you think your biases are. Because what I hear as well quite a lot is, just anecdotally, some people say, well, these kids, it's a choice and they make that choice and they're getting paid for it. And, in my day, we wouldn't have done that. But actually, if we think about the exploitation of children, it's happened throughout history, just in very different formats and guises. So it's always been there. Children have always been exploited, but obviously the way exploitation is now, it's predominantly around drugs and youth and gang violence. I think it's about really thinking about where are you getting your information from around child exploitation, and how is that feeding into your response? And how do you actually feel about it? Because if you feel that, well, I lack sympathy because I see choice, one thing I would do is challenge that, because where is the choice? Mm-hmm. Yes, that young people might choose on the surface to put drugs in their pocket or plug drugs inside their body because they know they're going to get some financial reward for that, but do they have the choice to leave that lifestyle? And I don't know of any young person who has been able to, without fear, leave that situation of their own volition without support. So it comes to scratching below the surface, and I think a big part of that, and I can't stress this enough, is really thinking about manipulation, control, coercion, and actually remembering that these young people, yes, they might seem to be acting in this way and there's a lot of bravado, there's a lot of front, there's a lot of aggression, but underneath they are very scared children, and that's what they are children. I mean, we're seeing now young people who are 14, even younger than that. I think it was only the other day that there was a child of 7 that was involved in this activity. So we are dealing with very vulnerable, very disadvantaged, frightened children.
I mean, it sounds to me that the key to a lot of this is about educating ourselves and, as you say, seeing behind the headlines and seeing behind our kind of automatic assumptions and responses and actually really starting to understand some of the reasons why. I mean, I like to think that working in this area, I know a bit, but even just in the last 45 minutes or so that we've been talking, you've enlightened me on some things that I didn't know. And I think that's that kind of constant seeking out new learning and education is just so key for anyone working in community safety.
And, yeah,
and I think I saw one of your posts on LinkedIn about the newspaper articles. I think there was one, was it about calling the young people drug dealers? I think that was one of yours recently.
I look at these headlines and you kind of think about all the work that you're doing to raise awareness in schools and raise awareness across partnerships, and then you see a headline like that and you kind of feel like you're taking one step back. And going back to what I said, I think the media absolutely has a huge responsibility to use their platform appropriately and wisely to educate the public. They're not drug dealers. Yes, they are trafficking drugs, but they are children who are being abused, who are being trafficked, who are being violated. And, you know, and I talked about the fact that they are scared, frightened children. There was a case which involved West Midlands Police where children were being trafficked from Birmingham to Lincolnshire for the purposes of trafficking drugs. And they were cuckooed in a property for, I think it was about 3 weeks. They couldn't shower. They didn't eat properly. They were, you know, just in squalid conditions around drug paraphernalia. And when the police actually raided that property and they saw the police, they burst into tears. And these were young men of 16, 17. And when they saw the police, they just burst into tears because of the situation they were in. They didn't see any way out other than to be arrested by the police.
It's just incredibly sad. And I think you're absolutely right. We just need to start looking behind the headlines. I picked up on one thing that you said there, which was about, you know, the amount of support that young people need to kind of leave this life, these lifestyles. And I just wondered if you could give us some examples of how you can kind of, I mean, and this would never be the job of an ASB officer, but those support workers that are working with young people to help them to leave these kind of lifestyles, what kind of level of support are they needing? What kind of things do they need to get them out of this lifestyle?
This is a particular area of challenge, and this is why for me it has to be about prevention, because it becomes incredibly difficult and complex when you've got young people who are really entrenched in this lifestyle and entrenched in exploitation. And the reason for that really is, you know, I know we've talked a bit about financially, it can be really difficult to get them to see that there's a way out of that lifestyle, because if they've missed school education, that they know that this is the only way that they're going to earn that kind of money. And if, like I say, they're contributing to family finances, that can be really difficult to step away from. So I think in terms of diversion, it's about that mentoring. It's about understanding the situation from their perspective, recognising that they're a victim, recognising actually the factors that pulled them into this lifestyle. It could be an unmet health need. It could be the fact that they've got, for example, some kind of ASD that's never been diagnosed, which has made them really incredibly vulnerable to exploitation. And if that need isn't met, if that need is never recognised, actually what you could do is through mentoring and through like a real proactive multi-agency approach, you might help that young person step away from that environment only for them then to be re-exploited. So that's really key as well, looking at their level of need and responding in a real holistic way to it. But it is for me, I can't stress this enough, it has to be about prevention. And I think that nationally, the challenge is that youth violence has exploded. Mm-hmm. And the problem of criminal exploitation is huge. There's massive gaps in intelligence, and it feels that the national picture is one of firefighting and being reactive as opposed to being proactive, because resources and attention has to be focused at where there is that real high level of need. I understand that, but I think if we're ever really going to get to the bottom of this, it's about looking at the broad spectrum, so those young people who are at risk of, as well as actively involved in exploitation.
And I know that one of the things that we spoke about before we started this interview was, you know, part of the reason why we have got these gaps in intelligence is that perhaps the national agenda doesn't recognise the role that housing officers or ASB officers have to have in terms of providing some of that information. Mm-hmm. That, you know, a lot of the, some of the stuff that we've spoken about today in terms of the signs that there might be a problem are things that it's more likely that housing officers and ASB officers are going to see. So it's how does that information get taken into account, because that might be filling in the intelligent gaps that we're currently seeing.
Yeah, and you know, I know that we talked briefly before we started to record this podcast, and so you know that I'm really passionate about this and the role of ASB professionals, because they are the eyes and ears, they're the ones that are on the ground, they are going to see that activity and have the opportunity to really trigger that early intervention. And you know, I think if we're thinking about tackling child criminal exploitation, it really does require a full partnership response. We're never going to tackle it if we're just focused on the role of statutory organisations. And I think if you look at the public health approach to violence, it's got six broad criteria, and a few of those I think are really relevant for ASB professionals. So one of which is about being for and with communities and working with those communities. Not being constrained by organisational and professional boundaries, and also, like you say, based on that data collection and intelligence sharing. So, you know, ASB professionals play an absolute key role in all of this and need to be at the table. And I'm a big believer in that. It's not just about health education, social care, sat around there talking about what's going on in the locality. If you're ever really going to understand what's happening in your local area, it needs to be a much broader partnership response, and it absolutely needs to include your ASB professionals.
And I know lots and lots of very motivated, very enthusiastic, very passionate ASB professionals who would, you know, love to be more involved in you know, trying to tackle some of these issues. Do you have any advice on how they might get a seat at that table? You know, how they might kind of put their hand up and say, we're here and we can help?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, like getting to know your partnership. So who in your partnership is involved in this agenda, and who can you link in with so your voice is heard? So I think a real good link for ASB professionals would be, like I said earlier, would be to know your neighbourhood policing teams, and to get involved in those discussions and that intelligence sharing. Ask what meetings are going on around child criminal exploitation, and being really clear on what your contribution can be. So talking about the intelligence that you've gathered, the observations that you've made whilst doing your frontline work, and being really explicit that you know that you can contribute to those conversations, and actually that you need to be aware of what's happening at a strategic and a wider organisational level in terms of the response to youth violence and child exploitation. I think that's really key as well, that you know what's going on more broadly.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I mean, again, we spoke about this a little bit, didn't we, in terms of the fact that, you know, it's about being really clear what you can bring to the table, so it doesn't look like you're just trying to stick your nose into something that isn't of interest to you or need to you. So, you know, really explaining what benefits you might be able to bring to the discussions and etc. And just reaching out and asking questions and being curious and finding out what's going on out there.
Definitely, professional curiosity. But I think as well, another key tip I would say is get to know your voluntary sector as well, you know, that are out there providing those interventions. So get to know your substance misuse professionals that are working in the young person's team. Get to know who's providing some intervention, whether it be like a Positive Youth Foundation or St. Giles. And get to know them, talk to them, talk about the support that they're offering young people and how you can liaise with them to help them really map what young people are in the area and what you're seeing on the ground locally.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. I mean, my partner manages a young person's drug and alcohol service, and he's, you know, always really grateful for information that comes from the ASB teams or the street wardens about, you know, where there might be an increase in young people, so that he then knows where to target his resources. So I think you're absolutely right. That kind of communication is so valuable to both teams, but both of them have got the shared aim of trying to make things better for those young people. But it's just, yeah, so important to be sharing that kind of information across teams.
It really is. And you know, I'm mindful that I don't want to go off on a tangent now and start and talk about contextual safeguarding, which is a completely separate topic in a lot of ways, but it's really pivotal and key to tackling child exploitation. You know, talking about your partner and grateful for that information because he knows then where he needs to do the outreach work and tackle the issues that are arising. It's around really identifying locations as well where young people might be at risk, and feeding that intelligence in. I think a lot of intelligence gaps that the police have is around those hotspots for young people, and knowing where the risk is. Because, you know, thinking about youth violence as well, thinking about where maybe tensions are simmering, where you've got a convergence of young people from different postcodes perhaps. And again, I think ASB professionals play an absolute pivotal role in that. If we're going to embed contextual safeguarding approaches, they need to be at the table.
Definitely. And Nikki, I think what you've done is volunteered yourself to come on again and talk about contextual safeguarding.
I'd be happy to.
You have to be very careful what you say to me.
I'd be more than happy to.
I really like what you say there about the voluntary sector, because I think sometimes in ASB we overlook the important role that the voluntary sector can play. Again, just thinking very practically, how can we find out what's available in our area? Like, would the MASH have that information? Would kind of the youth offending team have that information? How do I find out what voluntary sector services are in my area?
I think the MASH is a really good place to go. You know, sometimes what you find, it depends really on the local area, but, you know, with like SEND resources, you have something called a local offer, so you can see all the services that are available to support children and people with SEND. And I know that some local authorities have something similar for the voluntary sector. But if you can't find that information readily on the local authority's website, then I would absolutely say go to the MASH, ask what's available, and do that regularly as well, because as we know, tenders can be short sometimes and services come and go and commissioning changes. So yeah, I would say that make sure that you have a note to do that quite frequently as well, so you're aware of any changes.
So even more reason why we need to find out who our contacts in the MASH are then, and maybe go and offer them a coffee to go and sit down and find out a little bit more. Nikki, I'm really...
Yeah, definitely.
Sorry, carry on.
No, I would really echo that and say I think that's a really good way to sit in a MASH and understand the pressures that they're under as well. You know, going back to the point around thresholds and referrals not being accepted for whatever reason, have that conversation, initiate that conversation with the MASH and say, look, we want to be making really good quality referrals that give you all of the information that you need. Give me some guidance, give me some top tips, and yeah, have a coffee and just observe the workings of a MASH.
No, I think that's a great idea. Yeah, really start building those relationships, I think.
Yeah.
Nikki, I'm really conscious of the time. It's kind of just flown away with us. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I say I've learned a lot. So I'm fairly sure that anyone listening will hopefully have taken away a bit more knowledge around what CCE is, but also you've really helpfully provided some really practical advice and guidance, which is always the purpose of these podcasts. I think it's a great way of sharing knowledge, but above all else, I really want the aim to be practice changing and improving. And I think you've nailed that in terms of the advice that you've given and some of those resources that, as I say, I'll make the links available for. Just before we wind up, it would be remiss of me not to give you a couple of seconds, really, just to talk about how people might be able to get hold of you if they want to talk to you a bit more.
Yeah, definitely. So my website is being built at the moment. So yeah, I've not got a website that you can access, but you can find me on LinkedIn. So I'm under Safer Together. So if you look for Nikki Holmes, and you will see Safer Together on there. And it's quite, it's quite an identifiable logo, really, all different types of blue. But yeah, what I can do is when the website is live, is I will give you the details of that. So if anybody wants to get in contact or get in touch and look at some webinars and training that I'm going to be providing as well, they can do that way. But I would say at the moment, definitely find me on LinkedIn.
Fabulous. What I'll do is I'll include a link to your LinkedIn profile on my website where this gets posted. And also when your website goes live, let me know and I can share the details around my mailing list as well.
Oh, thank you.
So, and I suppose that to anyone listening who's not on my mailing list, I think, because I'm very biased, obviously, that it's a great way of getting hold of these podcast episodes, blogs that I write regularly, guidance, letting you know latest news, etc. So if you're not signed up, it's completely free. I don't use it as a big sales push. If you just go to my website, which is www.janinegreenasb.co.uk, you will get a pop-up box that allows you to sign up and get all the information that way. So, Nikki, I can't leave without saying a massive thank you. I am so grateful for, one, your time, two, your knowledge, and three, for sticking by with the IT issues. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Good. And also then a huge thank you to everybody who's stuck with us for the last hour. As I said, I hope you've got some benefit from that and has found it as interesting and enlightening as I have. As always, I'm always open to suggested topics for these podcasts, suggested speakers. Hopefully next time around we'll be back on the normal software. But yes, if you'd like to volunteer yourself or suggest any speakers or topics, please do get in touch through the normal channels, which just leaves me to say thank you and until next time.